And I have memories as a child of hearing my uncles arguing over which was the fastest way to get to my grandmother's house, you know. And they would just argue about this kind of, you know, you took Southern Boulevard? What are you, crazy? What are you, nuts? You know, they would do this, and I would start to cry. I would tell my mother, why are they fighting? She said, they're not fighting. They're just having a discussion. My paternal grandfather, Max, was a student of the Torah and the Talmud. And that meant not just studying the five books of Moses, but it meant studying the over 2,000 years of rabbinical debate about what various biblical passages might mean. Jews do not have one answer to any question. We have hundreds of answers to every question. That's why I enjoy this church. I went to a funeral service a few weeks ago at the Universalist Church in Champaign-Urbana, and somebody got up and gave a talk on the importance of doubt. And I went, wow, am I in a church? This is amazing, you know? Yeah, the importance of doubt. I think the big problem that we have is certainty. I mean, you know, we've got the answer, you know. Jews have hundreds of answers. We don't have one answer. When my grandfather would ask a Gentile neighbor to come in to open the refrigerator door on Saturday, because if you open it and a light goes on, that is considered work, and you're not supposed to work on Saturday, on the Sabbath. I would ask him, where in the Bible does it mention refrigerators, Grandpa? And he called me a smart aleck in Yiddish, which he didn't speak English, but would try to explain his interpretation, and the discussion was on. I love that tradition of discussion and debate, and I think that partially led to my choice of career as an English literature teacher. I could not believe that I actually got paid to introduce students to great books and then lead them in discussions and then often debates about what these books mean. I mean, they paid me to do that. I didn't understand. I'm from a working class family. My father worked in the garment industry. You know, I mean, he worked. I was teaching books. It was like, what is this? You know, why? You know. One of the first classes I taught at Wabash College in 1980 was an introduction to African American literature. And I realized, because the students were 95% white and lived in rural areas where there were virtually no people of color, they knew only stereotypes about other people they were reading about, and also, understandably, many held serious prejudices toward these people, which is understandable when you're separated from people and you don't grow up with them. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn. I went to a school that was half black, half white. I mean, you know, it's a totally different world that I grew up in. The best classes, and this didn't always happen, were those where there were more than one African-American student in the class. I did not want to make those students spokespersons for their race, but I tried to create an atmosphere where everyone was comfortable enough to say what they really felt about the books we read and the topics they raised. When the conditions were right, bridges were built and connections were made. Over the years, I saw students, both black and white, become meaningfully open to each other. But that meant being honest, becoming vulnerable, often arguing, but doing so respectfully. I'm sure over the years that some students in those classes did not completely expand their original perspectives, but not immediately, but at least they were exposed for the first time to different people, those with different backgrounds and experiences, and they interacted. And that's why diversity, I think, is so incredibly important, and that the Supreme Court better get themselves together on this, because that's, in the schools, sometimes it's the only places where we actually interact with folks who are different from us. And so this was a revelation, I think, for these students. I do have evidence for growth. In an American literature survey course I taught in the mid-80s, I decided to teach a slave narrative called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl that had never been part of the traditional works I taught or that I learned about in grad school. I taught people like Emerson and Hawthorne and Twain, right? These are the people I taught. The book described the life of a female slave in pre-Civil War North Carolina. I don't know how many of you have heard of this book. Harriet Jacobs is the writer. And didn't sound like any of those other books in the syllabus. It didn't have the sound, you know, it was her voice, and it didn't sound like Twain, and although Twain is special in terms of voice. One of my brightest students, a very conservative young man from Frankfort, Indiana, raised his hand and asked, "Professor, why are you wasting our time with this book?" He said that in class, which I thought was extremely gutsy of him. He didn't like it, he didn't get its value, and thought I was cheating him out of a real education in the classics of American literature. And I almost didn't get tenure at Wabash College because certain conservative students went to the administration and said I was doing this. I was not teaching the real literature. I was teaching black women writers. What did that happen? This is 1980. We've come a long way from them. Well, pretty much. And so I almost didn't get tenure, but I did get tenure. So good for Wabash College. Well, I can't say this question didn't annoy me when he raised his hand and said. And probably my initial response wasn't all that it should have been. But I heard him and ended up writing an article on why we can't just throw a totally new work into a class without preparing the students for it. You know, it wasn't right to do it. It was pedagogically a mistake. And he got me. He proved to me that that was the case. His resistance led me to an understanding that I would not have had if he had not spoken up. I must add that the student, by the time he was a senior, had become quite open-minded. He is currently a professor at Wabash and was my colleague for many years, and we became good friends, and he asked me to be the best man at his wedding. So it's a nice story. We just played golf last week. And I mean, you know, people change, people grow. This didn't mean I was indoctrinating them. I wasn't thinking, you know, you're going to come to my side. But just open up your mind, open up your mind. But a college classroom, in case you don't know, is not the real world, is it? Right. A college class is a captive, often diverse group of students meeting for 15 weeks. Over time, trust is established and difficult discussions are part of the course expectations. Students are even graded on how well they conduct themselves with others with whom they may disagree. I mean, it's in the syllabus. We say, you know, you need to learn how to talk to people who are different from you. Where else does that happen? I mean, but it happens at colleges and universities. In contrast, our everyday interactions with neighbors, coworkers, or even family, of course, do not have this structure. In everyday life, it is difficult to bring up controversial issues without the fear of strong emotions breaking out and ruining everybody's day, right? So maybe it's better, we feel, to just let things go. And is it even worthwhile to go to the trouble to have these conversations? What would it accomplish? But if we do feel, as I and I would think many of you do in this room, and I'm sure you do, that having meaningful conversations with those on the opposite side of our political divide could actually help bring us together and maybe make our democracy stronger, how exactly can we make that happen? First, how do we actually come out of our personal bubbles to interact meaningfully with those on the other side? The last time I spent serious time with any Republicans, and serious time, you know, was in working at the polls during the primary election. Right? I don't know if any of you worked the polls. I do that every 2 years. I work the polls, and I've done that for years. And so state election law requires that a Republican and a Democrat initial each ballot, especially in the early election. Okay. We sit next to each other for 6 to 8 hours. You know, Republican here, Democrat here, 6 to 8 hours, a couple of days a week during the election. I really enjoy those times. We get bored, so end up talking about our past, our kids, where we like to eat, what we do for fun, and anything else that comes up except politics, because at the polls, you cannot talk about politics. It's hard. Oh. But close, I don't say anything. Okay. I end up thinking, these folks who are voting for people I generally detest are seemingly interesting, bright, and nice people. How can that be? You know, it's like I get up after 6 hours. I like this person. They like me. We got along. And then we go our separate ways, right? My other venue for hanging out with them is during my weekly retiree golf outings. My wife can't even believe that I play golf. You know, growing up, I didn't play golf. Working class kid, and you know, it's too expensive. She says, are you a Republican? She says to me, I said, talk about generalizations, you know, associate, well, but I understand. Of the 14 of us who play from April to October, I'd say 9 or so are Republicans. That's 9 out of the 14. When politics come up, things don't usually go very well. And I've had several occasions where things got really ugly in terms of interactions. They all worked at a factory in town, Donnelly's publishing company, and I was at the college. And so they knew where I was coming from, and it was hostility. You could feel the tension underneath. A few years ago, after one of the horrific school shootings, one of my golf buddies showed up wearing an NRA hat with an AK-47 outline on the hat. It's a week after, I don't know how many kids were murdered in a school. It really upset me. And I told him it was ruining my day. It was ruining my round, which is, you know, trivial. But that. He said he hadn't paid much attention to the hat he had put on, but this was one of his favorites. After a brief back and forth, we agreed to leave politics in the parking lot, and he said he wouldn't wear it during our golf matches. But we certainly did not have a serious discussion on guns and violence on the first tee or in the parking lot. I mean, you just feel like you can't, then why are you wearing that hat? Do you know what just, I mean, I wanted to talk to him, but it was like, I couldn't do it. Over the years on the golf course, we've developed a joking, buddy-like atmosphere. And I have to think again that these all seem to be decent people. But how can they believe what they seem to believe? How can they think of voting for him? After my years of teaching, I actually long for a chance to have some deeper conversations with these men. But how could I even begin to try? You know, it's just very, very difficult. One of the guys I play with all the time, you know, just mentioned something at one point about being on vacation in Hawaii, blah, blah, and he said, and this Jewish guy picked us up in a car. And I said, how'd you know he was Jewish? You know, I mean, you know, it's like, I at least said that. And he said, and he got a little flushed. He sounded Jewish. I mean, you know, do I sound Jewish? I mean, I don't know. Do I look Jewish? Does he look Jewish? What are you talking about? You know, so we had the very beginnings and I think he started to think about what the hell did I just say, you know, which was great, which is as far as we could go. Recently, though, I read a book that gives very specific advice about how to have such discussions in our real lives, and I want to share some of the author's ideas. I led a discussion of this book a few weeks ago at the Montgomery County Democratic Club, and it was eye-opening. First, you might be wondering, how could Crawfordsville and Montgomery County have a Democratic Club? All right, I'm sure you're thinking, really? It's very tiny. There's just a few of us. Okay, but at the book discussion, there were 14 people showed up, which is many more than show up at our general meetings, you know. I realized, though, that during the evening, however, that the fact that we were all Democrats in this room didn't help put into practice most of the book's advice. We weren't reaching out over the divide. In many ways, we were reinforcing the divide by sitting in that room and talking about them. So I'm called another meeting, and I'm hoping each person's supposed to bring a Republican friend. So we'll see how that works out. Okay. The book is called I Never Thought of It That Way. Does anybody know this book? I see your head shaking. Do you know it? Does anybody know it? I never heard of it before. It's by Monica Guzman. Okay? Guzman, who migrated to the U.S. with her parents from Mexico when she was 7, was motivated to write the book after her parents voted for Trump in 2016. As a liberal, she could not believe or understand how they could vote for a man who called Mexican immigrants, like themselves, rapists and drug dealers. And you may remember that in 2015. It was one of the first speeches he gave. My skin is still crawling. They had many arguments over this, but she loves them so much that she wanted to find a way for her to argue productively with them and not like so many families split apart. And so that's what motivated her to write this book. Hence the book, which I must admit, I was extremely reluctant to read. it was suggested by somebody in the group. They said, "Try, you know, maybe we should talk about this book." As a committed partisan and a know-it-all discussion leader, you know, it's going to teach me anything, I strongly believed that I had nothing new to learn. I just didn't feel like wasting my time learning how to talk with them. Wouldn't my energies be better spent beating them at the polls by convincing the sane ones to just open their eyes? I mean, that was my attitude before I read the book. And I read the book. I've had this feeling this year about my Republican neighbors that reminded me of a film I saw growing up called Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I think we got the right demographic in here. Some of you remember this movie, okay? Some aliens invade the Earth, right, if you remember, and little by little turn humans into their slaves. The affected humans seem to act normally, but you could tell something was off by their lack of affect and by the tiny mark on the back of their necks that indicated the aliens had entered the system and sucked the humanity out of them. That's how I kind of see my Republican friends, which, you know, this is pretty horrendous. Clearly, this dehumanizing attitude toward the other side is not an ideal basis for meaningful conversation. Are you an alien? You know, I mean, it's like, are you a zombie? I mean, she talks about zombies. We consider the other zombies. Okay. Guzman's main thrust in the book is to shift conversation from debate to the kind of curious discussion that makes both participants, and she wants to keep these conversations small and face-to-face, seem human to the other. The aim, then, is to de-emphasize winning or winning the other over to our side and to build bridges over the divide where we can meet somewhere in the middle. And I think this is actually wonderful. I just think it's kind of what this church is about, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that this is what the Universalists want to do. In our discussion time, we can talk about whether in these seemingly critical times we can afford to have open discussions that de-emphasize our side winning. But let me lay out a few of Guzman's strategies so we have tools. So I'm just going to talk briefly about that, and then we can get to discussion. I just want to say my wife won't even read this book. I mean, you know. We have our debates, and you're pie in the sky. I mean, she thinks I'm completely off the charts with my hopefulness, you know. She says, "This is a waste of time. What are you doing?" You know. I said, "How about reading the book? You know, when would you read the book?" She's like one of my bad students, you know. I said, "Ones who don't do the reading." Anyway, let's not go there. I love her. Guzman first describes the SOS that has gotten us into this divided state and keeps us there. Sorting, othering, and siloing. We sort, which feels like a natural human attribute, by seeking out people most like us. We tend to live and spend time with people who look and think like we do. I just want to say quickly about that. You may have read statistics about the divisions in our schools right now, the segregation in our schools. It's worse than when I was a kid. I mean, kids come to Wabash and they'd never been in a classroom with an African American, with a Latino or Latino American. We're completely more and more separated, both in schools and I think also in where we live, in terms of our living situations. And she has all kinds of statistics about that. So we sort by being separated. In these separate worlds, we tend to other those we do not see regularly, and make exaggerated or false assumptions about what these people are like and what they believe. And finally, our sorting and othering is reinforced by siloing. We live in information and experiential silos that just echo back to us ideas that we already have that blind us to the complexity and richness of the other person's perspective. And you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I know you know this. It's just amazing. You saw the reaction to the Trump thing. It was totally different. You know, it reminded me of the O.J. Simpson trial, when you know people were cheering and people were sobbing at the same time. So these different, you know, and it's true. I do not turn on Fox. You know, that's not what I do. I listen to MSNBC, and that's what I do. But this is not Good. This is not good. Guzman's answer to the problem of SOS is bridging. It's what we do, she says, when we step out of our silos and try to see things from a different point of view. It can take patience, humility, and a good heap of courage, she writes. We could build these bridges by having deep conversations with those on the other side that involve intense listening and through telling stories rather than reciting facts and using reason. Telling stories, not just facts and information. These conversations can lead both sides to say, I never thought of it that way. I never thought of it that way. You can see why this essentially narrative approach would appeal to an English professor. I mean, I love it, you know, stories, you know, it's not statistics, not facts. And I screwed this up recently, big time, after one of our golf matches. We're just sitting around and, you know, talking and eating, and one guy, so somehow the space thing came up, just going to the moon and all this stuff. And one of the guys I play golf with every week turns to everybody and says, well, you know, we never did land on the moon. I said, I'm sorry, what? He said, no, we never landed on the moon. That's a fact. He said, this is a fact. How do you know that? You know, I mean, I just like, whoa. And he said, well, one of the ways I know it is that none of the astronauts have put their hands on the Bible and sworn that they were there. That's what he said. And I went, ooh, okay. So I go home, you know, and I'm a teacher. I cannot abide this. So I find an article in the Smithsonian Magazine, and I send it to him. It took every argument that he argued right off the table. It was written by a, if you'll excuse the expression, scientist. So, you know, I mean, what can I say? So, so I sent it to him, like Mr. Teacher, and I haven't heard from him in a month. And I saw him on the course last week, and it was like, you know? I went over and said, aren't you going to wear a hat? It's really hot out here today. You know, and he went, oh, yeah, I got a hat in the car. So I blew it. I mean, I basically did what she said not to do. Lecture. I have the answer. You know, that is not going to change his mind. I mean, he's got this. He's on conspiracy sites, and he's not going to change his mind. I goofed, according to her book. I had to say what I said. Okay, two quick examples, and then one quick thing, and we'll talk. I know. I'm not a lecturer. I never was a lecturer. Okay, two quick examples of hearing stories that widen perspectives for Guzman and her mother. First, her father tells her that he grew up in a country that he didn't see as committed to following the law as he thought the U.S. was. Mexico at the time, he felt, was not. He remembered people making fun of his own father for paying all his taxes. This upset him. So while he thinks the immigration laws should be fairer, he does not want people to break the law to immigrate here. Guzman never realized how strongly her father had felt about this and how understood, and she understood for the first time how he could support the Republican position on immigration, which she couldn't understand it before. She was coming at it from a different perspective, and he was coming at it from a totally different perspective about his early life. This opened her eyes. Guzman's mother, an extremely strong Mexican Catholic, had grown up with a negative view of homosexuality, seeing it as sinful. Yet as she told Guzman one day, they were talking, as she was walking down the street in California, she noticed two men walking in front of her holding hands. She then saw one tenderly kiss the other on the side of the head. It immediately struck her that these two men actually loved each other. They were human beings with the same feelings for each other she had for her husband. It was a transformative moment for her, and telling her daughter was a moment of reconciliation. I mean, she realized, oh, yeah. My wife read that and said, that didn't happen. I said, yeah, do it. She's lying. She doesn't. I like to think it did happen. I mean, things do happen like that, right? Moments. You know, I went to a conference with a bunch of students at Wabash, and I took them to a gender studies conference. I was very cocky about it. There was only men there. There were like 150 women, and 12 Wabash students were there. And I'm talking, they're talking, and then a woman from Oberlin, where my daughter eventually went to school, so I knew what it was, she said, okay, great that you're doing this stuff for gay stuff. What are you doing for trans? And I said, what? I didn't know what it meant. I mean, this was 25, 30 years ago. I didn't know what she was talking about. She said, what are you doing for trans? He said, oh. So that shot me down big time. And then in my next class, I invited a Wabash grad who had transitioned. Andrea James is her name. She's a very well-known activist, trans activist. And she was in my class as an English major at Wabash College. And she was completely, you know, not out as trans at Wabash College, where you wouldn't have been safe, and has become, you know, whatever. And she came to class, and that was the way the students completely changed their attitude about trans and stuff. If only Mike Braun had been in my class. So, I'm sorry. I know we're not supposed to do that. I'm sorry. But, you know, we saw a film called Southern Comfort, which was about, I don't know if you've seen it, you know this documentary? It's a trans documentary about a Georgia trans group. It's phenomenal. And these kids watched this movie, and their mouths fell open, and they just said, ooh, this is not what we knew. They completely changed. Okay. I urge you to read the book to appreciate the complexity of Guzman's understanding of how we dehumanize people on the other side of the political spectrum, but I will just leave you with what I see as her most important suggestions for having the quick conversation. You need time, attention, parity, containment, and embodiment. I'll quickly explain that, and then we'll get it. When we feel that the time might be right to begin a deeper conversation, if it's possible, and I may have a conversation with some of my golf guys at some point, Guzman suggests that the first conversation needs to be time. You need to give it enough time. You need to spend at least an hour kind of getting together and talking. That's why I think the polls were helping me, because I had like 6 hours to talk to people. All the stuff gets broken down, you start to see the other person. Okay, so you need time. They deserve a minimum of an hour to be able to form bonds that build trust and depth. Second, we need to pay full attention to each other, to listen intently without being distracted by the next thought we have that we feel we must express. I mean, that listening is one of the hardest things to learn, right? How to really listen, because we're always thinking of what the next thing is. We can say, shut up. Okay. The third thing is parity. We have to be on level ground with others in a conversation for it to do the meaningful work for all of us, sharing equal status and at least a chance of equal speaking time. So we've both have to speak the same amount of time, and we don't have to bring this status thing. I think that's the problem I had with my conspiracy theory guy. Right away, he saw this is the professor. He thinks he's smarter than I am. I might have embarrassed him by sending him the note. I mean, you know, there's emotional stuff going on, and I blew it on that score. Big time, because I did it over the internet. I mean, I sent him an email. If we were talking face-to-face, we could have had a decent maybe talk about this, whatever. The other is containment, making sure we're speaking with one other person or a very small group. This is the opposite of engaging in online discussions where we can be totally lose control of our focus and response, where we are performing our ideas, not sharing them responsibly. We're performing. You know, right? We throw stuff out there. It's an awful venue. And finally, embodiment, which is related to the previous one, in-person interaction. We need to see a person's gestures, facial expressions, how loud or insecure they sound. They need to see ours to have honest and full communication. And if you know some psychology, I mean, I think she's a gestaltist. That means she's aware of the way people look. And it's so important, right, when you're having a conversation, to be seeing what the other person is reacting. I mean, if you're standing like this, you're not listening, whatever. So I think this is brilliant. These are brilliant suggestions. I have just touched the surface. This is a very complex book, and she's very bright. She did a TED Talk, which I hate the TED Talks, but she gave one, and I think seeing her, she's a tremendous person. Okay, so clearly, we can't have the kind of conversation Guzman suggests in an email or Facebook account, but it's my hope that we can have them somewhere and soon. Not to overstate the case, maintaining our sense of community may depend on it. Okay, so now time for discussion. Okay, so here I welcome reactions you have to anything I've said, but also I'd just like to hear if you are in a situation in your family, amongst your friends, where there is this division. Have you experienced what I've luckily not completely experienced, but I have experienced to a certain extent? And if you could just talk about that, have you had conversations that worked out, where you felt were reconciliatory ones, and or have you had ones that were horrible, and what was the difference? You know, so let's just talk about this. And please speak up, because I...
Yeah, I first want to start out on a tangent that my grandfather was also a Brooklyn Jew who golfs, so you're not the only one.
Get out of here. Oh, my God.
He did, yeah. So in terms of successful experience with this type of conversation, I find that... So I was raised atheist, and, you know... I constantly meet people who've never met someone who is atheist. And I am in a knitting group in my small town of Greencastle. And I found that that's a regular meeting of a small group of people who are doing an activity with their hands while talking, right? And we had a very productive discussion about, also based on a story of one of the women's relatives who had moved to a different state out of the house that they grew up in, and suddenly, you know, she felt lost their religion and she wanted to understand why. And so, you know, that was one of those conversations that ended in, oh, I never thought of it that way, in terms of, you know, I was talking to her about how sometimes when you're in a culture, it takes until you leave it to understand what you really believe, and you wouldn't want someone to fake belief, right? You wouldn't want someone to come to your church not really believing what they're saying. And she took that to heart. And so, yeah, I feel like those kind of groups are really good for that kind of conversation.
And the group was, you're saying, a group of atheists?
No, it's a group of knitters.
Knitters.
Yeah.
Doing something.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
I'm just curious about... if you formulated any kind of plans or notions about, rather than just waiting for an opportunity, but somehow creating perhaps an opportunity with your golf buddies, because I have a similar situation where there's somebody who a couple of times has brought up some subjects that can be controversial. She brings it up and then shuts it down. And of course, you know, she wants to have her say, but there's not really an opportunity for anybody else to engage because of the limits of time, et cetera. So she's in there and does a quick and then out, you know. And it's like, I feel like this, that all of us really have some obligation to hold this person a bit accountable for their behavior. But at the same time, getting everybody on board on a master plan and committing to it to have like a little intervention seems to be really difficult, because nobody wants to be, I don't know, stir up any more problems than there might already be.
Didn't have a syllabus and structure.
I have to say, as you were talking, I did write down, I was like, these conversations would be easier if we could hold everybody to the syllabus. But we don't have a syllabus for all of these conversations. But I wrote that down with a little smiley face as a joke on my thing over there, Liz. If you could just get her to agree to the syllabus, it might be easier. I'll come up here to Deb and then back over.
So I'm in a new work environment. I've only been there a couple months. And my boss, I'm sitting there and I'm working on the computer. We have a great relationship. We talk about kids. We talk about, she's 30 years younger than I am. But so I hear conversation, and then I hear those damn liberals. And I went, okay. This is a woman I adore. She is an advocate for me. She has been great to me. I'm like, okay, I'll just sort of let this slide for now. And so we're talking, and she goes, and my damn sister-in-law, she's one of those damn liberals, and she's ruining the family. And I went, I said, so hey, I'm a liberal. No, I didn't. I said it very gently. I said, look, you know, clearly there's something going on. Could you sort of share with me this ruining your family? And she said, well, she's condescending. She makes my in-laws feel bad. She goes on. And I said, oh, I said, those aren't liberal values. That's rudeness. And she went... oh, I said, I am not, because I'm in this really awkward situation. And I said, you know, I have really deep respect for you and I love our work relationship. I said, and I am not going to try to sell you on anything that I believe. I said, I'd prefer we just, you know, when things come up. And I said, but I said, I just sort of wanted to know. And so, and actually the tell me more was kind of my way into it. And when she described the behaviors, I said, that's, you know, basically I just kind of laughed. I said, oh, that's not being liberal. That's just being rude. And I'm really sorry you have to go through that. So it was, my stomach hurt the whole time. Because I really like this job and I need to pay my rent, so.
How did she respond?
She goes, I guess I didn't, you know, it was kind of that, I didn't think of it that way. You know, it was more of the, oh, I said, you know, we may not line up. I said, but, you know, we kind of talked a little bit more later. I said, you know, liberals love their children. You know, we respect cleanliness. Some of us respect godliness. You know, it's just sort of like we have some things in common here, and we have a great relationship. Again, I really respect her, but it was that moment where you're like, okay, tell me what bothers you about this.
And it sounded like you really handled it the way Guzman would have suggested. Well,
I mean, I really like her, and I got to work with her. I mean, I really respect the person. She's a fabulous mom.
I was just going to say that I occasionally have some family that politically we are totally opposite sides, and we vacationed with them several months ago and happened to be talking about it, and it felt like it was starting to get a little testy. And the thing that I tell myself when I get in a situation like that, what I try to remember to do, is just ask a question. Just ask a question. Why do you feel like that? What would you think if this happened? And I think that kind of helps, rather than, like you said before, telling them something or lecturing.
She's got all of these questions. I mean, that's exactly what she had suggested as well. I mean, I think it's so important.
On the whole subject of trying to get people talking about these kinds of things, you're fighting middle class values, you know, because all the important things you talk about, if you're middle class, you're not supposed to talk about. And if somebody's of a different class than you, you're not even supposed to associate with them. So, you know, that's something that I think about for any group that's trying to be really open is, you know, if, I mean, I'm a non-binary, gender-fluid trans woman. If somebody comes in who's just beginning to transition as a trans woman, they're learning all over again their emotional life, and they're starting out at 12 or 13 because that's when they can't follow the girls because the girls don't want the guys around. And so they may dress, well, usually they dress either like, kind of like a whore. You remember what you all dressed like when you were 13? You know, short skirts and lots of makeup and all that stuff. And so they go back there and they go through, you know, or sometimes they dress like their mother. You don't know what you're going to get, but they don't look appropriate for their age often. So, but you don't treat them any different than you treat anybody else. So, because, and then there's lower class people who, you know, just to get to be able to talk to them, you've got to be open to the fact that you have some prejudice against them just because they're lower class, if you're middle class.
I think that's so important. This, you said middle class, and I would also say middle west. I mean, living here, you know, my transition from being a New Yorker and realizing that people are conflict diverse. Mm. My favorite story is going to Kroger when I first moved here, and I was in a line and I was looking at the labels on something, and I just had the sense that there were people behind me. There was a line of people waiting for me to finish reading this thing. If I were in New York, I would have been pummeled. I would have been on the line. And somebody would have stepped, what the hell are you doing up there? You know, you're reading the Bible? Come on, move. I mean, it's a totally different modality. So there's the Midwest thing. And then there's the class thing. You're right. We're just so stuck in these silos, and we keep making them bigger and deeper in our gated communities and stuff like that. tell me that if this sounds like I'm being, when I say, why do I feel like some of the motivation for having these kinds of conversations kind of come from our side more than from their side? Is that a terrible general? I hate to even say it, but I don't, you know, I just like feel like I want to reach out to them, bring a Republican. Are they going to reach out to us? And, you know, or are we so stuck in the winning? You know, our side has to win, which I think is really a big problem. You mentioned gender earlier. I mean, this is the kind of thing, we've got to win, we've got to win.
I do want to make sure we still have a couple more songs to do.
I can
hold the discussion to continue after we are done.
The Democratic Club had the money to buy. We bought books for everyone.
That's what I was going to say.
Did they read them all? No. I mean, literally, I was sitting there, well, I skimmed it.
When you say there's a Democratic Club in, you know, Crawfordsville and Montgomery County, most people don't expect there to be a Unitarian Universalist Church in Danville, Indiana, Hendricks County, so is there. At this time, we are going to do our offering. So whether in community with others or as an individual, we know that active, tangible expressions of love, justice, and peace are what make a difference. I encourage our members and friends to consider giving to the church, the donations link, or the QR code on the back of your bulletin. Each month, our congregation also chooses a local nonprofit, and if you didn't know, we are now in June, not May. That just happened. So our June nonprofit is Hendricks County Pride, an organization of community members driven to build and foster an environment of love, acceptance, protection, and pride for all members of this community in Hendricks County. And it is the Hendricks County Pride Group that is doing the Pride Picnic that we will be at the end of the month. We also have our food collection, if you remember to bring something in today. I did, Logan was gonna do it, but he decided not to. So if Annie brings it down, I'll add mine too there. As a reminder, every Sunday we collect donations for the Shared Blessings Food Pantry, which is operated right here in Danville. As you are able, please consider bringing in non-perishable items and placing them in our collection bin. Our goal is to fill that every month and give to our neighbors.
Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, and Jews got their own version of the truth. There's a line in the sand, there's a war going on. They forgot to remember, they might be wrong. Carry your faith everywhere you go. Mix it with love and let it show. But keep your mind open as you move along. And always remember, you might be wrong. Why do we argue? Why do we fight?